Welcome to the Astrophysics Podcast. Each month, I've found a different astrophysics PhD to interview about their life and their research. And over time, I start to get this concerned feeling that I'm eventually going to run out of folks to interview. That's probably not really going to be a problem, but I put a lot of constraints on myself. The interview is always in person, and they have to be every single month, which means I need to catch 12 PhDs on their way through Indiana each year. So for my own sake, it's nice to take a break once in a while and have a more laid-back episode where I don't have to find someone new to interview. So this episode, Dr. Abigail Pullen and I will be answering your astrophysics questions gathered through a combination of email, social media posts, and other sources. We will answer them almost completely unprepared so that you can hopefully watch our thought process in action. We find that our listeners span a wide range of ages, experiences, and interests. And this makes me really happy. One of my big goals of this show is to bring content that professional scientists and engineers could enjoy, but meanwhile maintaining regular listeners who knew absolutely nothing about physics or astronomy, but were just interested. So, please enjoy this month's episode and Astrophysics Q&A with Dr. Abigail Pullen plus an extra special guest. I'm Paul Duffel, and this is the Astrophysics Podcast. Welcome to the Astrophysics Podcast. I'm Paul Duffel, and my guest today is Dr. Abigail Pullen, Professor of Physics and Astronomy at Purdue University. Hi, Dr. Pullen.
Hi, it's a pleasure to be back.
Thank you. I think about this when I introduce guests, I always say, you know, thank you for being on the program. And they always say, thank you for having me. I would like one of them to say, you're welcome. And so I hope one day I'll be a guest on something and I'll say, you're welcome. But anyway, so this month, this episode is going to be a little bit different for a number of reasons. So of course, normally what I do is I get an astrophysicist on. You've, of course, been on this podcast multiple times.
Indeed.
Normally I get an astrophysicist on and I ask them about how they grew up and then ask them about the science they're doing. This episode is going to be different. Partly because we took some time off and we don't have any content for you. The last two episodes were actually already had been recorded a while ago, so we have a couple episodes that are recorded as well, which are going to be great. We still have Dan D'Orazio and we have Wenfei Fang, who are both excellent guests. Dan is one of my longest running collaborators. And so we had a fun time recording it. But this episode, it's actually being recorded a couple days before airing, and
risky.
I wanted to basically do something that I haven't done before, so it may or may not work. But is I just solicit questions from as many sources as I can, and just see what people ask me and see what, and we'll try to answer them. And I have kind of set it up where only one of us, probably most of the time, has the question in advance. So,
right. So the questions I ask, Paul hasn't seen before,
and the questions I ask, Abby hasn't seen before. And so we, you know, that way, like, it keeps things so that way I don't have a pre-prepared response. But then, you know, of course, most likely I won't know the answer. And so, so one of us at least has seen the question in advance.
Oh, did you expect me to look up answers to these questions? I'm kidding. We'll do our best.
The other thing I want to do before I start, first of all, remind you of who we are. Of course, I am the stupid host of this stupid podcast, but I...
Don't be self-deprecating.
Don't be self-deprecating. That's my whole personality. But I grew up in Seattle and moved to New York to start grad school. Abigail here grew up in Pennsylvania. She moved to New York
to start. And that's where we met.
And that's where we met.
And since then, we've been California, Boston, several places before landing ourselves professorships at Purdue University.
Yeah, right here in the middle, in the crossroads of America. And now we're married, and we have, we can talk about the latest news.
Oh, yes.
I'm not talking about the Vera Rubin, which we can talk about also, but...
But yes, we just had a baby, which is why we had some time off and we're doing this podcast this month.
Exactly.
So hopefully she will be, you know, content throughout all of this. But
yeah, we have the baby right here with us. And so you may occasionally hear her make noises during the podcast, which, you know, is a bonus. If she starts wailing, we'll edit it out. But, you know, that's how, you know, we just play it by ear like any good new parents have to do.
Yep.
So that's our latest news, which has been consuming our entire world. But in terms of other news, I'm not going to talk about. There's plenty of news in science that I don't feel like talking about. But let's talk about the big, happy, exciting news, which was the first release of images from Vera Rubin.
Yes, Vera Rubin. The Vera Rubin Observatory, host of the LSST, just released this past week their first images from the new telescope, and they were phenomenal.
They were great. Maybe I'll first ask you what your sort of impression was, and you can even give your impression of like this press release relative to like when James Webb had their release.
Not even comparable.
Oh yeah.
They did such a good job.
That the JWST release wasn't
good. The JWST release was fine. Yeah. I think the images chosen weren't as exciting as they could be.
Oh, okay.
And you know, they were exciting to us scientists because they showed a Hubble Deep Field, I believe, and it was taken in a fraction of the time as the Hubble, and it was slightly better resolution. But side by side, people who weren't astronomers wouldn't necessarily think, oh, this is a huge improvement, even though it was.
Yeah, maybe not as obvious to the public why this was such a dramatic improvement to the Hubble telescope.
But the choice of the LSST press release... first of all, they showed the giant image that can be taken with, I think it was two pointings of the LSST, of two pointings of the telescope.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that was phenomenal enough. I believe they described it as it would take 400 of the highest resolution, largest televisions to display this one image at full resolution.
Them using that,
you'd need a basketball court sized TV, ultra high resolution TV. So what they did is they kept zooming in and zooming in and zooming in until we could get to a point where we can see
where it can actually be resolved on our TVs.
Yes. And
right, that's the crazy thing. I thought that was an interesting thing. It's a big challenge for them because of the nature of the data. It's very hard to convey. You know, for example, if they just show an image you get from it, you can't resolve the detail on your the screen that you're watching it on.
Right.
And so by that nature, you say, okay, let's just keep zooming in until it's possible for you to actually see the detail.
And things that looked like specks or just pixels in the original image, as you zoomed in, became more and more and more galaxies. It was truly phenomenal.
Yeah.
This data is also available for you to play with online. It's totally a public release, so you can go to the website and, you know, zoom in on your own and see what's available in that image.
Yeah.
Basically, every speck of light you see is a galaxy or a star.
When I was thinking about it afterwards, one of the things that struck me about the Rubin Observatory relative to James Webb was thinking about how the nature of, first of all, it's a little bit more of a challenge for them to convey the interest in it, because with James Webb Space Telescope, James Webb is targeted, just like the Hubble telescope was targeted. Mm-hmm. You would pick an object you're really interested in and point it at it and stare at it for a long, you know, use a good long exposure and get a nice clear image of a very specific object. Whereas Vera Rubin is a very different purpose. They're not trying to look at it, individual objects.
Right. They're trying to map the sky.
They're just trying. Yeah, they're trying to get an image of the entire southern hemisphere, basically. So you know, all half of the entire night sky, and they can actually get a whole image of that without in not too long of a period of time. So then they just keep going back to that image over and over again.
Right, and that allows us to both go deeper and deeper and deeper each time we revisit the same area of the sky, as well as look for changes in between two right. different photographs.
Right. But so anyway, it was interesting to me because of the nature of the data is just fundamentally different. Like, it's not obvious you should be like excited about anything in particular in the image. It's not one thing you should be looking at. It's more just the conveying the sheer volume of data and how useful it is to astronomers to be able to just have a complete picture of the night sky.
Oh, we'll be getting science out of this for the rest of our lives.
And it's just so much data, and it's also really pointing to that fact that astronomy, all these different sectors of astrophysics are increasingly moving towards statistical understanding of things, rather than just looking at one object and going, "Hey, what's that?" You know,
yes.
is getting a statistical picture of how how frequent are these weird events that you're seeing? You know, are they correlated with this thing? You know, that
Absolutely.
Sort of thing. So anyway, I thought it was interesting, and I thought it was surprised. I was impressed with how well they were able to convey that during the press
yes.
release, because it is a little bit more non-trivial. You're not giving these pretty images of individual things that you pointed it at.
They did also very cleverly choose a very beautiful gaseous field to also show.
Yes, they knew to yeah exactly. They knew which images which. Examples to show, but yeah, I mean, fundamentally, that wasn't the point. You know, the point wasn't to, hey, let's look at this nebula.
Is that this new telescope with the largest camera in existence is able to map everything we're currently capable of seeing out there?
Yes. And I'll even mention your brother worked on that camera.
He did. So, maybe you can get him as a guest someday.
Maybe.
He was part of the camera team.
That's right. When he comes to visit the baby. that's all I have other than the questions to talk about. So maybe I should jump in. I got these from a whole bunch of different sources. Mm-hmm. And some of them are questions. Some of them are not exactly questions. They're just things. And then some of them are a bit longer, and I'll have to paraphrase them. So... we'll see. I solicited them from Blue Sky. I got some from emails. Some of them were emails that were just sent to me of people that listen to the podcast. And I was like, oh, and I emailed them back. I was like, would you mind if I turn this into a question? And then...
Most of mine come from friends and family.
Which is fine, too. You know, whoever. I guess we should get started. I didn't have a plan. This is the problem. I didn't think this through. I don't have an order that I'm going to do this in.
Yeah, me neither. Well, I could start. I could start with what I'm pretty confident is the question from our youngest contribution.
Okay.
So this is a question from Joe, age 4.
From Joe, age 4.
How far is the farthest star and back?
How far is the farthest star and back?
And back.
Actually, that makes this the and back actually does make it an interesting question now that I think about it. But the farthest star is, okay, well, that's a whole, that's very, very, this question has so many layers to it, actually. 4-year-olds ask the best questions. First of all, well, you may have heard that the universe is infinite, right? So the simple answer is there is no furthest star. You go to a far enough star, there's a star further away. There's no star that's farther away. There's no star that's the most far away star from us. The universe keeps going on and on and on. So that's part one of the answer. Mm-hmm. But I suspect she won't like the answer to that question. So I will say, you could ask, you know, how big is the observable universe.
Yes.
What's the most distant star in the observable universe? Mm-hmm. Okay. I don't know. First of all, I don't know which star is the most distant star in the observable universe. I don't think we actually have observed it, probably, because it's probably very dim.
Yes.
But that would also be, in the observable universe, that would also be presumably the youngest star, because mm-hmm. it's one of the first stars that formed.
Right. This would have been what we call population 3 stars.
Population, that's right. It would be called a population 3 star. The reason I say it as one of the, or it's not the youngest star, it was the oldest stars. I don't know. It depends on how you, this is a very weird.
The first stars that were formed in the universe.
One of the first stars that formed in the universe.
Because looking further in distance is looking back in time.
Right? That's right. That's actually one of the favorite, you know, commonly things when people, for the public questions is like when you ask about, when you talk about something far away, they always say, well, how long ago was it?
Right.
That, you know, because you're this concept of looking back.
Right.
If the further away you look, the further.
Absolutely. Because what we're seeing are the photons released from this star. And because they had to travel so far, we're seeing photons that were released a very, very long time ago.
Yeah. This might be difficult for a 4-year-old. I'm going to say, though, but I'll still answer. We'll still talk about it because it's fun.
Yes, it's a great question. You know,
for example, when we look at the sun, we're not actually looking at the sun, what the sun is looks like to, right now. They're actually looking at what the sun looked like 8 minutes ago, because mm-hmm. that's how long it took the light to get to us.
Right.
So it took that long. So you have so you're only seeing what it looked like 8 minutes ago. Something happened to it within the intervening 8 minutes. We won't know until we wait mm-hmm. that time.
So if we look at a star at the furthest reaches of the observable universe.
Right.
It's kind of the oldest star, but we're looking at what state it was when the first stars were formed.
Right. So we're actually able to look into the past that way. Anyway, so the furthest star, I would say the distance to, I'm going to have, this is going to be a tricky question.
Yes.
But I'm going to say it's going to be around, like, in the sort of 14 billion light year-ish distance. Mm-hmm. And the reason I say that is because the universe is 13 to 14 billion years old. And so very roughly, very crudely, it's a non-trivial general relativity calculation to determine exactly, based on how the universe expanded in that time, how far away it is. But and it depends on what you mean by how far away it is. But the rough answer to that is 13 to 14 billion light years away, because the universe is roughly 13 to 14 billion years old. And you're hearing the baby now, which we're okay with, as long as it's not...
As long as they're happy noises.
As long as she's happy. So that's one answer. But then you said, and back.
Oh, right.
But that's actually interesting, because if you try to get there and back... During the time it took you to get there, the universe will have expanded.
Right.
So that's going to make the calculation a lot more complicated. if you take all that time to get there, eventually, by the time you get there, the universe will have expanded, and right. it may be, you know, 2 times, 3 times, 10 times as big as it was when you left. So then the answer becomes much, much bigger. I guess the answer is depends on how fast you go. Because if you take a long time to get there, you have the universe plenty of time to expand. And so it's at least... Let's see, it's at least 28 billion
right.
year, light
years. At minimum,
years.
Because you travel, if you're going at the speed of light, the 14 billion years.
These are all rough, you know, I didn't have time, because these were just read to me, I don't have time to do the actual calculation, but that's my rough answer, is at least 28 billion light years, but probably more. Mm-hmm. Good. Oh, that's great. Oh, my questions are going to suck.
Wisdom from babies.
Here's one. Okay, I got one from Robert. This is from Blue Sky. I should mention, why am I on Blue Sky? First of all, I'm like the most, the worst social media person ever. I hate all social media, and I but and I'm really bad at it. But once you start doing a podcast, you really are supposed to be on a whole bunch of social media to promote it, and I am I've completely failed at that. But I do have a Blue Sky account, which is like one of the least populated social media sites there is. But in any case, I used it. I got a handful of questions.
Do you want to say what that Blue Sky account is?
Oh, well, yeah. It's Paul Duffel at something, whatever, .bsky.social or something like that.
There you go. So they can find you and ask more questions.
Yes, you can just look for Paul Duffel on Blue Sky. You'll find me. Okay, so here's a question from Robert, which is, if you could observe at any reasonable distance, any known / theorized astronomical object, what would it be and why?
Oh, well, you know, I'm incredibly biased here.
Yeah.
I would, you know, my research is going after supernovae, so I could be, you know, really boring there. But what I'll choose a slightly more interesting one than just a transient in general.
Uh-huh.
I'm jonesing for the next kilonova. And so a kilonova is what happens when two neutron stars merge.
Yes.
And why that's exciting to us as a specific object is because currently, so long as LIGO gets to keep running with, its, you know, new funding
updates.
We're
going to keep talking about happy things.
Okay,
we're assuming LIGO will continue.
So with LIGO, LIGO gets to see gravitational waves, ripples in the fabric of space-time.
Yes.
From any... Well, ripples in the fabric of space-time, gravitational waves, are created by any non-spherical phenomena in the universe. LIGO specifically can see these gravitational waves from mergers of neutron stars and a few solar mass black holes. And so why the neutron stars specifically are exciting is because we get a gravitational wave signal, which tells us a lot about the binary itself, the mass of the stars, they're in spiral time, all those sorts of things. And then kilonovae are special as opposed to black hole mergers because they have an electromagnetic counterpart. So that means that light is also...
So for the four-year-olds listening, an electromagnetic counterpart... Well,
I was about to explain it before you interrupted me.
No, that's fine. I've gotten also... That's the most common complaint on this podcast. I interrupt people too much. But that's... whatever. You can listen to a different podcast if you don't like it. Anyway.
Anyways. So what I mean by an electromagnetic counterpart is that optical or even infrared, but light itself is emitted from the event as well. So when these neutron stars merge, parts of them tear apart and emit light. And that light is created by what we call R process element creation. So the creation, before you interrupt, of things like platinum and gold, these heavy elements that are only created in these events.
I will say, I do interrupt intentionally so that it is a conversation. It's not just one person monologuing about R process the whole time. So it's very difficult to follow when you just have one person saying that. But why don't I back up?
Yes, please do.
And for the four-year-olds, I know four-year-olds are fine with LIGO and gravitational waves and black hole mergers. But for the handful of them that aren't aware, the idea of, and we've talked about the LIGO Gravitational Wave Observatory before on this podcast, but the idea is it measures these ripples in the fabric of space-time, which are caused by large changing gravitational fields. And the ones that we can measure, the most dramatic ones, are with extremely dense compact objects, which are the most compact objects in the universe are either black holes or neutron stars. Mm-hmm. And when two of those sort of in spiral and merge, those produce the most dramatic ripples in the fabric of space-time that we're actually able to measure.
Absolutely.
And so you were saying the difference, though, we've observed black hole mergers, and we've seen neutron star mergers. Most of them are too distant to see anything else at the same time.
Right.
But the great thing about neutron stars is they have lots of... black holes, when they merge, it's just gravity. There's nothing else. There's nothing to allow us to see it in traditional telescopes. So when neutron stars merge, they can produce light in many other ways, because the material can... the material making up this neutron-rich, highly radioactive material that gets produced, can give us light in lots of other ways, like you were talking about R process and things like that. But anyway, yes. So And so,
the combination of the gravitational waves and the light,
yes,
is a very unique way to learn about the universe.
Yes, and it really constrains what could be happening. It actually gives you a lot more constraining power, which helps with science.
Whereas normally when we see a transient, we're kind of guessing what kind of star it came from. We're making informed inferences, but we don't typically have direct observations of things like the mass of the star that exploded.
Right.
And these neutron stars create elements that other transients don't create.
So maybe I should back up to the original question.
Yes. Why is this what I would choose to look at?
Yeah.
Because so far we've only seen one. Well, we've only seen one with a combination of both the light and the gravitational waves. Mm-hmm. And we've been looking for a while.
Right.
So that one was in 2017.
Right. And so seeing a second one where we saw everything,
Course, if I could choose, because it said I could choose, I'd want to catch the entire thing and, you know, all the optical wavelengths.
I interpreted the question a little bit differently because it said if you could observe at any reasonable distance, which I interpreted as, like, for example, if you go, like, if you were to see a star that's about to explode and you can go right next to it. Of course, reasonable distance means probably that you wouldn't be killed by it. So that's a little tricky. So what's the correct distance?
Great different interpretation. I interpreted that as anything possible to see.
Right.
Whereas you are saying, what if I was right next to the event?
What if you were right next to it? Like, for example, you do a bunch of theory on supernovae, and, you know, most of the time what we see, like you were saying, we get clues from the light that comes out. And it's very hard to get more information than that. You know, you have just this light, you can get a whole spectrum and you can learn things, but all you're seeing is the light coming from it. You're not actually seeing the star, like the material from the star. you're seeing light as it propagates through it. And so it's hard to do inferences on the details of that. And so, for example, if you were able to be right next to it, you could see what was actually happening.
Mm-hmm. Well, I have a different answer to that question.
I
would, you know, want a Star Trek scenario where I could actually visit other planets.
Right? Oh, that's a good answer. You could actually go, the implication is one.
Okay, well, I would visit the planet that we think is most likely
to form, to have life and that sort of thing.
Exactly.
Oh, good. Okay, good. I would like to be near a black hole.
Oh.
I'd like to be close.
How reasonably
by.
Close.
Reasonably.
You want to get spaghettified?
Not within the event horizon. Not within the event horizon, but reasonably close. I'd love to see that.
Mm-hmm.
I think that would be great. I think, because with black holes, it's really hard to hit, and then black holes is even harder to get real good data on them because, you know, either from our data is from gravitational waves where we see merging black holes or in spiraling, you know, basically we're seeing binary black holes, or we can see stuff that we infer there is a black hole, like there's material falling into the black hole and we see it light up, and that we make all these models for what is causing that bright activity. But actually right next to it, and particularly a black hole that has a disk around it and the jet, all that cool stuff going on, not just a boring one that's sitting there. I want to be right next to
with
one.
Activity.
A lot of crazy stuff. Of course, a reasonable distance, I'd probably get killed if it was any reasonable distance, but it would be
Although it's important to
fun.
Say, it would be hard to learn. It would take a lifetime to learn from that, right? Because there'd be so much going on.
Yeah.
And we wouldn't be able to, if you just got to see one system, we wouldn't know. It's the same thing as our solar system, right? We can say, well, maybe all planets work the same as our solar system, but then the more we observe, we think,
true.
We're not the average.
But how I interpreted the question was not in really a scientific one.
Oh, fine.
I was thinking, what would I like to go see? And that was my answer to that question.
I still
question.
Stick with the Star Trek planet landing.
Planet landing. That's a good answer. I didn't even thought about that, and that is a good answer. Okay, good. I have a lot. I think I have more questions than you.
Okay.
So maybe I should do a second one?
Sure.
All right. I got this one actually leads from your answer to this last question.
Mm.
So I have two questions from Charlie.
Okay.
And Charlie, first he asked me, do you think there's aliens? And then he refined his question.
Okay, good.
And he said, do you think there's planets that can support alien life?
Almost certainly.
To which question?
I'm a scientist, so I'm going to go with the second one.
Okay.
There's no reason to assume that we're unique in terms of having a rocky planet with water, which is what we think is required to support life, right? Mm-hmm. Obviously, there's more details to that, like temperature and atmosphere.
Right.
But statistically, we are unlikely to be the only Earth-like planet in a Earth-like temperature.
Yeah, right? And that's true. We don't. I mean, that we've, of course, over the past several decades, gotten a much clearer picture mm-hmm. of is that a lot of stars have planets around Earth size, and many of them are going to be at the right temperature.
Right.
So that's true. I would like to say we don't really know what, of course, and many of our listeners are thinking this too, we don't really have any idea what are the necessary conditions for life.
Exactly.
So we can use our own, understanding based on how it formed here, mm-hmm. To get, say, like, okay, if we have a right temperature and mm-hmm. you have liquid water, that was very important here to forming life. And so we can say, like, but it could be there's some planet that's not, maybe there's some form of life, not carbon-based or something like that, that didn't require liquid water somehow because we didn't think of it.
But the simple question of, is there an Earth-like twin out there in terms of our environment?
Mm-hmm.
I think statistically the answer has to be yes.
Yes.
We just went over how big the universe is.
Now, but do we think those mm-hmm. planets are likely to have life on them?
I don't see why not.
Yeah. I tend to agree with that. Of course, life is a big dip.
Right. Do we mean amoebas or do we mean humans?
We still haven't said aliens, but we have said life. I think it's what we found on Earth is that life seems to really, Jeff Goldblum's Life Finds a Way.
Yes, but it prefers crabs, actually.
But life likes to be, life likes to show up everywhere, even in the most inhospitable environments, life will form. At least a little bit of life forms. And so it's very reasonable to think if you have, if you have at all the conditions for life, that they'll form in a reasonably mm-hmm. short time span. But we don't know that for sure, because we haven't yet had our telescopes are not quite good enough to be able to really detect signs of life, but we're getting close.
Yes. We're getting to the resolutions where we could definitely say whether or not there's water on these exoplanets, for example.
Yes, that's right.
And a few other elements that we think are indicative of life, like methane gas.
Yeah, and once you get into more complex molecules and mm-hmm. things like that, then if you can actually demonstrate that those molecules are in abundance, then you'll be starting to really show that that's the case. But we're not quite there yet with our telescopes. We're very close. I say we. I have nothing to do with the search for life, but good. Okay, so I did two questions. You should do one.
All right, I'll start with a simple one. Actually, this one is from Ellen and Michael.
Okay.
They want to know what makes astrophysics physics versus just astronomy.
Oh, good.
What's the difference between astrophysics and astronomy, if we hear both of those terms?
Okay. Well, normally, so first of all, I don't think there's a consensus as to when you're supposed to use astrophysics versus astronomy. But for me, at least, usually, when I think astrophysics versus astronomy, like, I wouldn't normally call myself an astronomer because I don't do observations. So when I think astronomy, I usually think observational astronomy. So looking through telescopes or reducing mm-hmm. astronomical data, basically being on the experimental side of astronomy.
Right. That's certainly the historical answer.
That's, and astrophysics, I think I tend to put that more in the theory column, but nowadays it's, I think, much more of a catch-all term that goes to people working all the way from theory to observation. Yeah. So more people would call themselves astrophysicists than would necessarily call themselves astronomers.
Mm-hmm. So historically, I think you're right. There was a distinction between, are you a telescope person or are you a working with equations type person? However, in modern days, the terms are pretty interchangeable.
Yeah, that's right. So some people would call me an astronomer, and I wouldn't correct them, but but I don't look through telescopes. But yeah, so that's how I normally interpret the mm-hmm. difference. And she's giving me a funny look.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
okay. I think she's seeing me with the headphones on. It's like, what is he doing? Okay. Good. You said they had two questions?
Oh, no, that was one
question. Oh, that was one question. Yep. Okay, good. So maybe I should do a question, I guess?
Sure.
Okay. I have one from Mike Zingali.
Oh,
he says, why did my code crash?
I don't know, Mike. Why does your code crash?
That's Dr. Mike Zingali, who's a professor at Stony Brook.
And the joke is, I use his code a lot.
So he decided to answer my query on Blue Sky. But anyway, that was just a joke one. How are we doing with questions? Do you want to do one?
Sure.
Okay.
I have a kind of change in topic here.
Yeah, definitely.
This question is from David. How is the teaching of physics, and more specifically astrophysics, changing? And how do you see it changing further in the future?
Oh, that's a good question. I think generally teaching is changing a lot the past 5 years. Out of COVID, I mean, people have, it's got, and between COVID and the increasing use of AI tools and things like that for teaching, most of these things have been for the worst, but
a few changes are for the better. We can make things more accessible.
We can make things more accessible now. So generally, I should say teaching has actually the big shift has generally been in teaching overall. I think probably it's going to been even more so in high schools than it has been in our experience in college. It used to be, I mean, any of you who used to be in take classes and the teacher would break out a slideshow, everyone in the class would hate them. But now that's the norm, yes. Is that teachers will teach from slides rather than the chalkboard or the whiteboard. So that's a big shift. I never use slides, but I've occasionally had reasons to use them, but I always teach from the chalkboard. It's just much more engaging. So I think that's one thing but that's not specifically about physics.
I think it probably reached us last, honestly, or feels like us last, where we have so much of our coursework is derivation-based.
Right.
I suspect we got the slideshows last, but they're here.
Yeah, they're here, and it's hard to get rid of them.
And in my experience, which is more limited than yours, I've been teaching for less time, but when I announce that I'm not using slides, at first students are really perturbed, and by the end of the semester, they're into it.
I guess the other point I'll make regarding to teaching changing in physics and astrophysics is the big thing I found, so we're in a physics department. The big difference between a lot of times the classes that in astrophysics that we teach versus our colleagues in physics is in astrophysics, we can't teach usually from the same textbooks that we learned from because astrophysics changes so rapidly.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, when I was a student, we didn't know if dark matter was real. We didn't know if, we had never observed another planet outside our solar system. Mm-hmm. Like, there's a whole bunch. Never observed gravitational waves.
Whereas electromagnetism hasn't changed since Maxwell.
Right. Like, the basic fundamentals of physics are still the same. I mean, I'm sure there was a big revolution in the modern physics in the past century.
How we teach these subjects has changed a lot.
Yeah.
But
so what do you mean by that?
So, I mean, from, over the last century, let's say.
Okay.
A lot of teaching has gone from rote to practice-based.
Yeah.
For example, that's a good thing. I had a professor in college who had this huge rant about textbooks.
Right?
Of how... if you're not careful, lectures should be outdated because once upon a time we started the lecture because books were expensive and not every student could afford a book. So the lecture itself was the textbook.
So the teacher would just be reading the textbook to the students.
Right.
And that was the lecture because the students didn't have the textbook.
Didn't
and they
have
would
a copy.
And they would just take notes.
This was a very old professor, by the way. Right? He was also a really great teacher.
But he did.
His name was Engelbert Schücking.
But that helps to give some perspective on how much that has changed.
And he said, you know, we need to adapt with the changes of what is more accessible.
Right.
And now teaching is not just reading the textbook. It has to be a give and take where you're available for questions, you're doing derivations, you're engaging the room and having a purpose that's more than just talking at the students.
Yeah, I think that's a good point to bring up too about teaching is it's the increased accessibility should always mean that we then teachers start doing things, your job is different. Mm-hmm. The easier it is for students to get information on their own, the more the onus is on the teacher to figure out, well, okay, what can I provide then? What is the service that I can provide that beyond just regurgitating what is already available to them?
Right.
And so as information becomes more accessible, we should be working.
And I was going to college in the era of the internet becoming a very useful resource. Suddenly Wikipedia was accurate.
Right.
There were things like Khan Academy. And so I've always done a lot of thinking of, okay, so then what is my purpose if theoretically you could watch my course on YouTube, right?
Good. This leads me into another question.
Yeah.
Okay. I got one from Clara. Because you said you can you could learn everything from your course or whatever. You referred to a course.
If we're not careful.
If you're not careful. Yeah, yeah. I have a question from Clara, which is, how are stars made?
Oh. Are you asking me this because it's related to the course I taught last semester?
That's right.
Yes. So I taught Stellar Evolution. Let me say one more thing before I answer that.
Okay, that's fine.
Right. So in the current era, we have unlimited online resources. We're starting to see AI come into things. So I really try to focus on what is the personal, what is the apprenticeship nature of teaching? How can I be a resource of give and take with the students? And that means active questions, active problem solving, learning how to learn together.
Yeah.
Instead of just regurgitating information at them.
Yeah, yeah. Good.
Okay.
All right. So are you ready for Clara's question then? All right. How are stars made?
Yes. Oh, it's a good question. She knows the answer because she was in my womb during this section of class. Right. So stars start out at what we call a protostar, which I will explain right now because that's not a very useful definition. But basically, there's a bunch of gas out there in the universe, probably part of a disk of what we call interstellar medium, just gas out there.
Okay.
And basically, once enough gas gets together, it starts being gravitationally attracted to itself, right? And when that happens, that gas cloud will start to collapse and get closer and closer together.
Okay, so you have a big cloud of gas, and it's so massive that it gravitates upon itself and causes itself to collapse.
And so it's slowly collapsing until it gets dense enough that we reach the condition required to be a star, which is that there is fusion going on at the center of the star.
I see. So thermonuclear fusion.
Yes.
So as it collapses, it gets hotter and denser, and eventually it gets so hot and dense that you start to trigger thermonuclear fusion in the core.
And so when that happens, we start to release energy. And that energy will halt the collapse, right? Because it's creating a pressure that fights gravity. And so at that point, our cloud stops collapsing and we have a star.
Very good. That's a very nice, clear explanation. good.
Again, I just taught this.
Of course, you taught the class, so I would expect nothing less. But, you know, that's very nice.
I have something fun we can start us off with.
Okay, so why don't you do yours?
All right. So this next question is actually a call-in question.
The next question is a call-in question.
A call-in question
that
Paul hasn't heard yet.
All right, let's hear it.
All right, here we go.
Hi, my name is Mabel, and I'm wondering, I've seen pictures of the sun before, but how do satellites get the picture or anything else get the picture because if we get too close, they'll probably burn the cameras? So how do we get pictures of the sun?
All right, I'm going to repeat the question.
Okay.
Just in case we decide not to use the recording part. But our next question is from Mabel, age 9. And she has seen pictures that are very close up of the sun and wants to know how we can get those pictures without burning up the camera.
Right. That's, first of all, a really good question that I hadn't thought about. But do you want to start on it? Because that's really hard. I'm sure that's where most of the technology went into. Like one example. So actually, we can first talk about examples of telescope or one of the latest satellites that we've put close to the sun was the Solar Parker probe. Parker Solar Probe. Well, I'm very good at this. You can tell I'm doing this off the top of my head. So
yes.
Parker Solar Probe. Why did I call it the Solar Parker Probe? The Parker Solar Probe. But it's an incredibly sophisticated instrument that mm-hmm. is able to get really close to the sun and not just get amazing, beautiful images, which it does. And you can look those up, but it also can get really detailed measurements of the turbulence in the sun and the mm-hmm. hot spots and all the details of like things that we have talked about with theory for a long time, but now are able to really get detailed yes. observations of, which is kind of incredible.
And I'll have to admit, I actually, Mabel, had to look up some information about the Parker probe since I knew this question was coming.
Yes.
So some fun things I learned is that the Parker Solar Probe made the closest ever approach to the sun last Christmas Eve.
Oh, last Christmas Eve, it got its closest so mm-hmm. far?
Yes. So it's on an orbit that gets a little closer each time. And this past Christmas Eve, December 24th, 2024, almost said 2004 there, mm-hmm. 2024, it entered the lower part of the sun's corona for the first time.
Oh.
And you're right, that area is really, really hot. So a huge part of the technology of the satellite is making sure that the telescope, the cameras, don't burn up. And the answer to how we do that is it's a little of a cop-out answer here, but there's a really, really good heat shield. So this heat shield has
to... Don't ask us how we make the heat shield.
Yeah, it's some carbon material. But the tricky part is making sure the heat shield is always in between the sun and the camera.
Right.
And only like a tiny bit of the camera pokes out, right? So that heat shield, just for numbers here, is able to withstand a temperature of 2,500 degrees Fahrenheit, which is 10 times hotter than your oven. And it keeps the telescope, the camera, at a temperature of 85 degrees Fahrenheit, which is, a pleasant summer day.
Yeah, and so that is incredible. You can do that with a heat shield.
Yeah.
That you can block.
And thank you for this question, because I learned all about it. Apparently, at the end of the lifetime of this satellite, we'll run out of fuel. That's the fuel we need to keep the heat shield in between the camera and the sun. And so eventually what will happen is, at the end of the lifetime, the camera will face the sun and get burnt up, and that heat shield will go on orbiting potentially forever.
So, okay. So the idea... Oh, the heat shield to keep on orbiting. So the idea is that this satellite is sort of in an orbit around the sun, and each time it's sort of in a decaying orbit. Each time it gets to a smaller and smaller orbit. And then also the other thing is that you're saying that it's using its fuel to constantly readjust its orientation so the heat shield is always blocking this thing.
Yes.
Because if the heat shield moves out of the way, everything's toast, basically.
Yes, literally.
wow, that's very cool. So then it gets decommissioned, we'll just burn up the camera.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a reason we burn it up, or is it so that last shot of the sun, or?
I'm actually not sure if we're doing it on purpose or just know that
inevitably
happen.
That there's no way to avoid it once you run out of fuel.
That's, but we'll keep getting data from it as long as it doesn't burn.
Right, right.
So.
Okay, cool. That's a great answer. Well, I'm glad one of us was able to answer that question.
Well, again, it was such a good question, I had to do my own research.
All right, good. I had a couple of questions from Linton, who emailed, this is an email, the email questions are longer, so I have to paraphrase them. There was one question about Beetlejuice that I don't think I'm going to get to, but there's another question that I like this one, because it was asking about, you know, basically this idea of dark matter and how, you know, saying, like, there's so much stuff we don't know about in space. Like, for example, like, you know, there's lots of debris that's around and stuff that we... How do we know that, you know, we know that most of the mass in galaxies is not in the stars, but how do we know there's not just, like, a bunch of debris or something else that's not... Why does it have to be this magical dark matter thing? That's roughly... I'm paraphrasing the question. Mm-hmm. Do you have a good answer for that?
So how do we tell the difference between is it dark matter or is it matter we just don't see?
Yeah, well, ultimately, the phrase dark matter really just means matter we don't see.
Right, but it matter different from the type of matter we see.
Right.
How about that? Yeah. I think because we've looked at it every way we know how to look at.
That is the short answer.
Yeah.
I guess one of the things, the history of it, you know, goes back to the 50s and 60s and over time ruling things out over and over again.
Yep.
And one of the big things is like the sheer amount of it you would need, since it would be like 99% of the mass of a galaxy or something like that. It means that you would see absorption lines or something, anything. If it was made out of atoms,
right?
There was inevitably those atoms have processes we know, you know, would that they have absorption spectra and things like that. We would be able to tell, and so we can rule out basically things that are made out of atoms.
Yes.
And so then you can come up with other things, like there are other types of particles. You know, mm-hmm. For a long time there was theorized that neutrinos could be part of what dark matter is made out of, and I don't know if that's been completely ruled out, but I think it's mostly been ruled out. Anyway, but over time, the history of it over the past, I don't know, 50, 60, 70, 80 years has been a process of sort of ruling things out over a long period of time. And that's, so we know it's not made out of atoms, and we know it's basically not, we've ruled out almost everything that we have in our standard model of particle physics. And that's why people look for things beyond that.
If we want to take a step back, though, since we just kind of jumped into that question, I have another question where this was going to be the answer to my question.
Okay.
Salima asked, what are the big burning questions of astrophysics today?
Okay.
And my answer to that is dark matter. What is dark matter?
Okay.
And so we might want to take a step back and explain what dark matter is, since we didn't do that.
I should say... Beth asked a question that was also, what is the biggest mystery? Of all the mysteries in astrophysics, what is like the biggest outstanding things that we don't understand?
Yes. And so, I think that, for me anyways, that my answer to that is dark matter. So, Paul, do you want to do a cursory, what is dark matter in our understanding, and why why do we know it's there if we can't see it?
It's interesting because my answer was going to be dark energy, which is different.
It is different. We can get to that, though.
But anyway... dark matter is okay. Yeah, we'll go back. I'll go back to we should have answered these questions in reverse order. That's okay. I'm not going to edit it so they're in that order. Dark matter, ultimately, it's matter that we can't see, and that's the most basic fact about it. And
but
so once
you, how do we know it's there then if we can't see it?
Right. So exactly. So the raises two questions. One is like, what do you mean matter you can't see? But then if you can't see it, how do you know it's there? And basically, the main reason we know that it's there is because of its gravitational influence on things. It doesn't seem to produce light in any way. It just seems to interact with things via gravity in a very strong way, because, well, at least in a way, showing that it is a huge amount of matter out there, but it just doesn't seem to be producing any light. So, and beyond that, we don't know exactly what it is. And there's a lot of theories about it, and over, you know, like I mentioned, over the past better part of a century, it's a process of ruling out things that it could possibly be. So it was first discovered in the 50s and 60s when they noticed that galaxies seem to be spin rotating too fast. If you like estimate the mass of the galaxy based on the how bright they are from all the stars in it, and they see that they're spinning so fast that they're completely gravitationally unbound, they should be flying apart.
Mm.
And what that implies is that there's actually a whole bunch of mass you're not accounting for, that most of the mass in there is actually not accounted for. And that's that ends up being the mass we call dark matter. And, mm-hmm. you know, early on over the in the like 70s and 80s, it was popular to try to just modify the theory of gravity in order to fix these things. But then in the 90s, basically, there's two things that kind of ruled that out as a possibility. One was this thing called the bullet cluster, where you could actually do images of, you could determine where the mass in the bullet cluster was and where all the material was, all the sort of particles, mm-hmm. the gas, and they were in different places. So there was no question that there is stuff called dark matter, and you can see where it is.
Right, and that's one of our first examples where we got to go up close and go probe the region where the dark matter was with everything we know of to see is there atoms emitting in a different wavelength, and we found nothing.
And the other thing is we have found other ways to gravitationally tell where the matter is. For example, this gravitational lensing is that we can actually see light bent around galaxies, and we can demonstrate from that because light is being bent around it by gravity, which is a whole other thing, but that the point being that means that we can calculate how much mass is there.
Mm-hmm. And again, it's far more than the mass we infer from visible light.
Right, but so far, basically, all the big breakthroughs in dark matter have been showing that how much mass there is, and because we've only really confirmed its interaction with things gravitationally, so we've never seen we don't really know what it's made out of. We've only been able to rule out that it's made out of ordinary things, and so it could be a new type of particle that we just don't have powerful enough particle accelerator to create those particles, or it could be a type of, you know, I think most physicists could sort of look for, well, most physicists favor the idea that it's a particle. But there are other theories people come up with, like a whole bunch of, there's like maybe a whole bunch of what they call primordial black holes that are left over from the Big Bang that are they're basically, because they're black holes, they're not going to produce light, but they will have a whole bunch of gravity.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not as popular in physics.
Right.
They've ruled out most models for that.
And the trick is, it's easier to come up with a model than it is to come up with a model we can test.
Right, because it's so, it's so hard. So the different, I could go on and on about all the different things that have been tried over the past better part of a century to actually detect dark matter, but it has never been detected. They were hoping that maybe they'd get some hints at the LHC, and they didn't get anything like that. They hope that maybe we'll see some interaction of dark matter particles, say, like in our atmosphere, or with experiments that are like, they have these big xenon tank experiments where they hope that a dark matter particle will pass through and interact with it, even if it's really, really weakly, you know, it would give a signal. There's lots of experiments trying to do those kinds of things, but so far, no detections. and it could be that they just interact, if they interact with our regular world of particles, that it may just be a very weak process, and so we may never get to know what dark matter is. It may be too hard for us to measure. And the baby is not happy about that.
Yeah.
We did a graceful cut there.
Yes. All right. So we left off talking about the question from two sources, basically, of what are the biggest questions of astrophysics right now?
Yeah.
And we discussed my answer, which was dark matter.
Yeah.
Now we should probably discuss your answer, which sounds similar.
It's called dark energy. But basically, both of those, I think most It's really hard to say what is the biggest mystery, but I feel like both dark matter and dark energy are these sort of big, outstanding things where they are the two of the biggest things that shape how the universe formed, and we don't know what they are at all, basically. We've built models, we've been able to rule out a lot of things, but we haven't.
Right. Which is funny, because I think the dark and dark matter came from literally not emitting light, and the dark from dark energy meant mystery.
Yeah, I think it came from the fact, I think a lot of the things that get named in astrophysics get named at, like, nebula, I don't know, or whatever. They can name things that are like, we don't really know what this is.
Right.
And then later on, we figure out what it is. You know, like, so, oh good, we're getting positive sounds from her.
Yeah.
But yeah, so dark energy, I feel like they got that, and they just stole dark matter and called it dark energy.
Right.
But it's a different thing. Mm-hmm. It's even weirder, but it's basically, it is another, thing that we detect by its gravitational influence, but not in the same way as dark matter. We detect dark energy is something that seems to pervade all of the universe that causes the universe to be pushing itself apart.
Right.
So when we look at the history of the universe, that's a good sound effect. When we look at the history of the universe, and we look back in time and see how it has expanded over time, which you can do, and that's sort of the whole science of cosmology, right, is how has the universe expanded over time?
Right. So if we map the distance to nearby and farther away galaxies, we can say what is the rate that the universe is expanding, and is that expansion, say, accelerating?
Right. So up until the 90s, we thought we expected that the universe was decelerating because of gravity, because things would, even if things were flying apart, that they would be gravitationally attracted to each other, so they would sort of slow down.
Mm-hmm. And eventually start coming back together again.
This is what we thought up until the 90s.
Ever heard the term the big crunch.
Yeah, that was the idea. Right. Up until the 90s, there was this idea that either the universe was going to get a plateau, sort of expand out and sort of plateau, or it was going to collapse in on itself. But then in the 90s, it was discovered that not only is the universe expanding, but it's accelerating.
Right.
And so that required this idea of dark energy.
Mm-hmm. Some energy source that is making that expansion accelerate.
Yes. And so that's it's a little more esoteric, a little bit more mysterious, but it's basically it's a particular form of energy that has to, the energy density of the universe has to continue to stay the energy density of dark energy has to stay constant as the universe expands. So, like, for example, most forms of energy, as the universe expands, that energy dilutes over time, and so there's less of it, and so its effect is less. But dark energy seems to be the case that it continues to be just as pervasive as the universe expands, which means it's able to be continue to exert its force as it expands, and it causes the universe to accelerate faster and faster. It's very rough. I don't know how better I can explain it without launching into a general relativity exercise.
And why do you find this the most interesting, I guess, is the question.
First of all, no type of energy, no type of, like, standard energy that we can imagine does that.
Right.
That's one thing. The other thing is, the only thing that could do it, it was actually originally, the idea of it is actually theorized by Einstein, what he called the cosmological constant. Mm-hmm. It's some constant energy density term that would, you know, that was in the equations of general relativity that would allow for this sort of thing.
Right.
But he didn't actually like that term. He actually got rid of it. He tried to invoke it in order to get a static universe.
Yeah, there's a couple of fun times when, even when Einstein's right, Einstein doubts it and is wrong.
Yeah, that's right. But anyway, the whole point is that, like, you can get away with it mathematically. You can introduce something mathematically, but if you want to interpret it physically, it's much harder.
Right.
And I think dark energy. I don't know about dark matter. We may have that. We may. It's you could always possibly be on the verge of a discovery with dark matter. Maybe one of these big xenon tanks will discover dark matter, or maybe they never will. With dark energy, we do have hopes we can at least start to get a better understanding of how it works if we can do better observations of the history of the universe's expansion, right. How galaxies have clustered the way they have, and things like that. And we can get a better sense of, has dark energy really been a constant energy density for all eternity, or is there some, has it have some time dependence to it, and that may tell us something about how it works. And there's some hints to that with the latest surveys of galaxies, but and I'm sure that there'll be more exciting results on the way from other people who do these sorts of measurements. But right. Yeah.
But in summary, I think both of these topics are the big question, the big interesting question, because that's where we know that there might be new physics we haven't thought of yet.
That's right. It is. It's the fact that we have ruled out everything normal means it suggests that there's something in physics, in the laws of physics, that we don't understand, and that it's the answer. It's staring us straight in the face in astrophysics. That it's inescapable. Like, most of the mass in these galaxies is in this type of matter we've never seen before.
Right.
And the universe is accelerating instead of decelerating. Like, what could constantly, the fact that the universe is expanding is one thing, but that it's accelerating. Mm-hmm. What is doing that? There's definitely something doing that. So most conventional things you could imagine that exist in our current understanding of physics have been ruled out.
Yep.
So that makes it a big deal. It makes it exciting.
It makes it exciting, right? We don't want to have figured out everything.
That's right. But, it's still possible we can go for decades and decades without making progress on it.
Entirely possible.
But it does, those are some of the things that I think are, we point to the clearest, like, big mysteries that we don't have solutions to. Good. Yes.
Related to that a little bit, if I can go again.
Yeah, absolutely.
Joan asks, how deep can we look into space because of the James Webb telescope?
Oh.
Versus how deep could we previously see? And I bring that up now because the James Webb is probably the facility that's going to help us see those furthest away galaxies because of its sensitivity and the fact that it sees red light.
Yeah. Okay. So that's a good question. So it's hard to, in astronomers, once you get to large enough distances, astronomers don't usually work in distance. They usually work in the thing called redshift.
Right.
And the reason is because that's what we actually measure. We measure how fast galaxies are moving away from us, and that's related to how far away they are. James Webb has enabled pretty deep, redshift of something like 14 or something galaxies.
Those are the newest reported numbers, yeah.
And then there are some speculative ones where they are deep as 25, but those are based on,
they're more controversial.
Those
currently.
Are definitely very controversial.
They need to be followed up.
But the idea is that people are trying to push it even further. Mm-hmm. But the redshift is an indicator of you can think of it as a proxy for how far away they are, but it's also you can think of it as a proxy for how early, when you talk about how far away these galaxies are, you're also talking about, we talked about this before, how how long ago those galaxies are. These are some of the first galaxies that formed.
Right, and so we're seeing the earliest stages of galaxy formation.
If those speculative redshift 25 galaxies, those would be like some of the stars we're looking at there would be some of the first stars that formed.
Right.
Now, of course, we didn't do it. Yeah, again, those are speculative. But to give you a sense, we're getting closer and closer to even seeing the first generation of stars, mm-hmm. which is absolutely incredible. I don't know whether we'll actually get to see the first generation of stars with James Webb, but it's really it's on the edge of those limits.
Absolutely.
I don't know if that didn't really answer your question, but that's okay.
I just wanted to stress the importance of yet another NASA-funded satellite.
All right, that's fine. I have one from Gabriel, who is an undergraduate aerospace engineering student in Brazil. And he is interested, you know, he's interested in astrophysics and all kinds of things like that. And he's wondering if we had any advice for useful resources or key concepts that he should study to, like, you know, to put him on a path to, like, understand, to doing astrophysics. Like, you weren't prepared for this question.
I was not prepared for this question. Yeah.
So, like, in other words, when if you were to go back to yourself in as an undergrad and, like, say, here's the things you should actually learn, you know.
Yes. I mean, what I like to stress to my undergrads is, this is a cop-out answer, but what I like to stress to my undergrads is part of it is not just what you're learning, but learning how to learn.
Yeah, that's true. That is a cop-out, though.
Yes.
What about, like, so what about
what's
sort of
been most
what
useful?
About, yeah, coding skills?
Coding skills, definitely. A lot of the mathematics that I thought was just very esoteric and not going to be directly useful to me ended up wildly useful.
Yeah.
I think that's partly we're not so great at communicating where this math will show up.
Yeah. Learning how to do, like, learning how to do basic physics problems on a computer. So this is a good thing. I try to do this in my classes now, is when I'll teach people how to do some problem on, you know, with pen and paper, I'll also give them the assignment to do it on the computer, where the computer will do an integral, you know, or do some kind of calculation in a different way, but it teaches them important skills that they can apply to a lot of different things.
Absolutely. Another one that I know you stress in your classes, and I've started to stress in mine as well, is there's really no point in doing any of this if we can't communicate it to each other.
That's true.
Yes. So something I try to make sure my students come away with is understanding of how to communicate data via diagrams and plots effectively.
Yeah, that's a good one. Yeah, get some good plotting software and play around with it and try to make good. Anytime you have an assignment where you're asked to do a plot, really go all out and making sure the plot is clear and make it, you know, because learning how to plot things is, for some reason, like, we don't actually have a class, we don't explicitly teach it. We just hope students will obviously know how, but it's an act of communication. So yeah, those are all good answers. I'll give you a related question.
Okay.
While you look at the baby. So here's a programmer had a question. He said, this is from Blue Sky. He said, I'm curious about what the process is like for making physics models. Like, what is the output? What types of charts or graphs? What kind of files or what kind of codes? Like, what are the type of, you know, what kind of, you know, they're mentioning that we do computational physics. Like, what type of coding is involved in that?
Ah, that's a really good question. So a lot of what we both do is computational fluid dynamics. And what that means is that there's a set of differential equations called the Euler equations that are what govern fluid dynamics. So for us, a lot of the baseline of what our codes look like is solving coupled sets of differential equations that are not analytically solvable. So that means we can't solve them with a clean answer by hand. We need to
do it
over and over and over again in tiny, tiny steps, which is what computers are really good at, because we'll get a little bit further in time with one step of the computer, and then we'll say, okay, but then what happens? And over and over and over again.
Right.
So the codes look like that. That's teaching the computer the set of differential equations we would like it to solve. And then from there, you can play many tricks of, not tricks, but there are many methods of teaching a computer to do this more or less efficiently.
That's a whole different, that's a whole deep subject.
But the outputs.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, the outputs tend to look like giant data files of the information you're interested in. So, like, for me,
what is the density at each point?
Right. Yeah, for a supernova, an explosion, it's the density and temperature and composition of all of that material at every space and time point.
Yeah,
right?
That's a lot of data. And I should say, like, we typically, so we, well, so I write almost all of my own codes. So I almost just entirely just write those codes in C. And if you want to, you could talk about Castro or mention it.
Sure,
or how it works or what it,
one of my main fluid codes that I use is Castro, which is now, I believe, all C++ with some Python helpers.
Right. It has GPU capabilities, so it's super fast.
But I've used and written code in all sorts of language, C, C++, Fortran, Python.
Yeah.
I'm not a huge Python fan. It's a great helper tool, but it's not super computing efficient.
For us,
she's not a fan of Python.
She's
either.
Also not a fan of Python. You know, her parents have raised her in that sort of, with that sort of propaganda. But for us, for when we do really high performance computing, we find that those old school languages, C and Fortran, are still the reigning kings of the moment.
And what we mean by fast and efficient there is can solve more of the problem in less computational resources.
Right, exactly.
But yeah, the output's giant data files that we can turn into images or plots or, you know, exercise those skills we're teaching our undergrads. A fun one and a serious one. So which would you like first? What do you want to land on?
I guess do the fun one first.
Okay. I have a question from Mimi.
All right. Here's a question from Mimi.
What was one of the biggest astrophysics mistakes you've made, and how did it change things for you?
What are the biggest astrophysics mistakes that I've made?
Yes.
Have you thought about this?
I'm asking you.
Okay. I don't know. I don't like to dwell on those mistakes.
Oh, cop out.
I feel like I've made lots of small mistakes all the time.
The lovely thing about Paul is he does not mind sounding foolish.
Right. It doesn't actually get my... Right. If I'm like, oh, I was wrong, it doesn't really bug me.
Right.
A very common thing when you're at a conference and you're presenting something and they say, aren't you worried about this? I'm like,
no.
I'm not worried about that, no. Worst
Thank
case
you for
scenario,
phrasing that like a yes or no.
The worst case scenario is I'm wrong. that's not a problem.
To be... I wanted to talk about this one because, honestly, we're wrong a lot and we still learn from being wrong.
Yes, of course. But she was looking for an example
of
when I
example.
Was wrong.
I remember, if I can tell an embarrassing story about you, allowed to?
Yeah, sure.
You can always
edit it out. So yeah. I have ultimate control.
I remember once in a group meeting.
Oh, yeah. This is a good one. Go ahead.
This is a good one.
Oh, that's fine. Okay. Yeah. So I'll tell the embarrassing story. I was at a group meeting, and this is at Berkeley, and it was a big... Elliott Quadert has this big group meeting, and like one of the postdocs was presenting research they were doing on... I don't remember whether it was a neutron star or a white dwarf, but they were doing some calculation, and they were saying, we're neglecting gas pressure and we're neglecting radiation pressure.
Rah.
And then I said, oh, well, if there's no gas pressure and there's no radiation pressure, what's holding the thing up?
Right, okay.
And then they were like, well, it's a degeneracy pressure. It's a neutron star. And so that was the joke, is that I just like completely missed the fundamental thing that makes these stars special. That makes these things special. That was the story. I've had
mistakes on my part. Like, luckily, I've never had to retract anything I published, but I've definitely had things like I got through an entire model set and realized I neglected energy contributions from an important element and had to rerun things.
Oh yeah,
right?
Those happen all the time. Yeah. Everybody gets those.
I like to say this is why I became a physicist instead of a doctor. When I make the mistake, the worst thing that happens is I waste some money. No one dies.
No one's hurt. It's just you ran a code for a really long time that cost somebody a lot of money.
Which is not good, and we aim not to do that. But no one dies.
But honestly, like you can say, you aim not to do that. but it's impossible to avoid that as part of the scientific process. You're going to make, you know, that you're going to start and try something and then realize, oh, I didn't include this.
And because I didn't include that for those runs, I knew exactly what the contribution of including that was then.
Right. So you now actually had a better understanding of the problem.
Absolutely.
So that's always good. I don't know. I don't have a good I don't feel like that was my thing was a major physics, astrophysics mistake or thing, but
we're in a mindset of we like the mistakes.
I've had plenty of times when I would write a paper hoping to disprove another paper and then instead go, oh wait, they're totally right, and then I end up writing a paper just confirming, saying like I tried to disprove them, but they're correct. I've done that once, and I've embarked on a project being like, oh, I bet you this is caused by this thing, and then I realize, nope, this won't work, and then I write a paper showing that.
Yep.
I've done that before too. So I mean that, but those actually are some of the best. Those are some of my best work when I do that. So.
Right. All right. So I have a last question that, you know, maybe we can go back and figure out a better way to phrase this in the positive.
Okay.
Afterwards, but the question is from Daniel.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think the biggest impediment to research is, and what would you do if it wasn't there?
The biggest impediment to research? Lack of funding?
Yes, absolutely.
I think that's the simple answer.
Yes.
Is that basically professors are spend a lot of, most of their time thinking about how they're going to fund their research group. They're writing grants, and things like that. If we could free up that time and actually be doing science instead, that would be great.
My first year's faculty, which I just finished, I'd say 50% of my time was teaching. A remaining 30% of that time was applying for money. 20% of my time was advising students, and 5% of my time was doing my own research. Right.
I'll give another answer, even though that's the ultimately the most definitely true answer is money. But she doesn't like the money answer. Can we get away with...
I think we can get away with finishing.
Okay. I'm going to give another answer, which is that I think self-doubt is a big one.
A good answer.
Money is obviously the real answer, but in terms of like when the process of getting scientific results, self-doubt will completely kill you.
That's an excellent answer. Things like imposter syndrome.
I wasn't even going specifically to imposter syndrome. I'm thinking like even just, I mean, that's another example of it, but I'm thinking like even just when you're starting to write a paper, the process is you start writing it, and if you spend too much time writing one paper, like getting the results, getting the data, and it takes you too long, eventually you convince yourself this is really boring and you don't care, and like who's going to care about this paper? And I found, especially when I was a grad student,
it's also really easy to convince yourself, oh well, why am I writing this paper when it's all so obvious? But it's only obvious because you spent the last 3 years thinking about this problem. Yeah,
exactly. That's right. So to you, of course, it's really boring because you're reading this paper, you've been writing this paper for so long. But it may still be really interesting to other people. And I found that to often be the case, that I put out a paper that I think is just not that interesting because I've looked at it for so long. And then other people like think it's amazing. And I've had the opposite happen too. But I often have combated that. I found that I have to write a paper quickly. There's a deadline. If I don't get a paper written by a certain point, my mood just drops about it. If I can't get the paper out quickly enough, my attitude toward it completely changes, and I don't care anymore, and I lose all drive to write the paper. And so I need to force myself to get it out quickly enough that doesn't happen oftentimes. Your own self-doubt can completely, you know, you convince yourself that it's not interesting. It's really easy to do.
That's an excellent answer.
Why, thank you. Good. I'm glad we could end with an excellent answer. I think that's all of our questions.
That's all I've got.
Okay. Well, that was great. Since this is an experiment, I have no idea how we end this, other than to say it's been a lot of fun answering or not answering your questions, depending on whether you feel your questions were sufficiently answered. If we didn't really get to your question, I apologize. You know, we had a lot, and we had to get through them quickly, and we may have some of it got, may have got lost in the translation. That's inevitable.
And if you have more questions, you know where to find us.
You know where to find me anyway. You can email her too.
Well, I hope you enjoyed listening to us wrangle with your questions as we simultaneously wrangled a new baby. Next month, we'll be back to interviewing another interesting astrophysicist, but please let us know if you have any more astrophysics questions for us. Thank you again to Dr. Abigail Pullen for helping me out with this week's episode, and an extra special thank you to our listeners. We will see you next time. The Astrophysics Podcast is supported in part by the National Science Foundation under grant number AAG-2206-299. If you want to connect more, or if you have astronomy or astrophysics questions, follow me on Blue Sky at paulduffel.bsky.social. All of the music on the Astrophysics Podcast was written and recorded by Britton Ashford, and you can find it on her album Trotter. All songs are used with permission from the artist and producer. Look her up if you enjoyed it. This podcast is produced in beautiful Lafayette, Indiana, by me, Paul Duffel, professor of physics and astronomy at Purdue University.